The audible of the best in Bitcoin. This is the Cryptoconomy. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the show. We are closing out the week this week with a good one on the Swan Signal blog, actually. And this one is written by none other than Bitcoin Tina. And it was posted about a month ago. If you guys aren't following their blog, the Swan Signal blog, they have had some really great articles up there consistently by some awesome people. Obviously, Jan and Brady, who are with the Swan team. But also, they've got a piece up there by Brandon Quittam, by obviously Bitcoin Tina, and a number of other people. This one was actually posted last month, so it's just taking me a bit to get to it. But if you go to your Swan Bitcoin account, blog is just up right up next to login. So that's where you find it. And if you don't have a Swan Bitcoin account yet, well, then you're failing, because you should have one by now. With that, let's go ahead and jump into this piece. It's titled Bitcoin and the Technological Evolution of the Financial System. We are living in hyper-Bitcoinization, a process which is basically repricing the world in Bitcoin. This is because Bitcoin is actually much better than gold as a store of value. For the same reasons that many people like holding gold, I think it's a reasonable proposition that Bitcoin will wind up being valued at least as highly as gold. Imagining the future. It's hard to convince others of this because most people have a hard time imagining a world they don't currently live in. They can't envision how the future is going to be different from today. They can't picture the impact of new technologies. They dismiss them or write them off as bubbles or Ponzi schemes. Look at other technological changes. In the early 1900s, everybody used horses. Your options for transportation were a horse and wagon, or a carriage. And within a decade or so, we were using mostly cars for transportation, with very few horses. In my life, we've seen typewriters disappear and get replaced by computers. Calculators came around and slide rules disappeared. We evolved from using film to digital pictures. Technology evolves. It's hard for people to understand how quickly these things can take place. We used to use gold and precious metals as our only money. They have significant drawbacks, though. Gold has a fundamental security flaw. It's heavy and hard to carry around. And you can only do business with gold with face-to-face transactions. Also, there are issues with its extensibility. It's very difficult to conduct small transactions with gold. So, how did we solve these issues? We created banks as a technological solution to the problems that existed with precious metals. Once you had banks, you could deposit your gold with that bank, and that banker could then say, "This person is good for this money." That made it easier for you to conduct business. More recently, stock certificates came along as a technological solution to problems that existed with investing. They made trading a much smoother process. So we see that the financial system also benefits from technological evolution. Money as a simple machine. We don't think much about the money we use. People think, "I use money all the time. Why do I need to think about it?" But there are certain simple machines we use all the time that we don't think about either. The wheel is a very simple machine. We use it all the time, but we never think about it. It's the same with pulleys, levers, screws, wedges, the inclined plane, etc. Money is an essential simple machine that gets ignored too. It's core to our human existence. Related link: Shelling Out the Origins of Money by Nick Szabo. However, the money we use today is fundamentally flawed. Here's a thought exercise. Decide on a sum of money that seems significant to you. You can decide whether it's $10,000, $10 million, or something else. If you had to hold that amount of money for 20 years in just one asset, which would you choose? Cash? Treasury bills? Money market fund? Gold? Stocks? Real estate? The one loser that people would not want to own is cash. You may not know how the other assets will perform, but we can be pretty certain that if we hold cash for an extremely long period of time, it is going to become worth less over that period. Ideally, money would be a riskless asset that doesn't deteriorate over time. It ought to be the thing you can hold for a long period without having to spend it on a consumption item or invest it in something like real estate. The great thing about money is it gives us optionality. So it'd be great if you could hold your money in a way that is riskless while maintaining that optionality. Choosing the best ladder. Money may not be physical, but it's still a good, and people judge it by certain qualities. An analogy to consider, a workman's ladder. What are the qualities which might cause a workman to choose one ladder versus another? Height, weight, strength, durability, design, materials, etc. People choose a ladder based on those qualities, and if 1,000 workmen all choose the same ladder, they make that decision based on the qualities of that ladder and how well it fits their needs. Yet we don't think of money this way since it's just being dictated to us. We don't see the process of how money became money. But like the ladder, money also has certain qualities as a good. Based on our observations and judgments, we decide to use a certain currency. Money is also a tool. It's just become so much a part of us that we don't actually think about it that way. So let's examine the qualities we'd want in an ideal money. It would be scarce, impossible to replicate, reusable, portable, highly divisible, easy to secure, and easily transactable, even at a distance. All that sounds a lot like Bitcoin. To go back to our analogy, Bitcoin is the ladder we want. Over time, everyone will end up buying Bitcoin because of its outstanding qualities, and the more people come to understand this, the more they're going to want to hold it. A conservative investment. I think of Bitcoin as a conservative investment because it's so superior to gold. The value of it should wind up at least equal to gold's value. Different types of people will pay successively higher prices for it, though. Skeptics will overcome their objections first, then the cynics, and then the haters. And the haters will end up paying the highest price. In the end, Bitcoin will wind up being adopted as the world's one and only money. Some skeptics argue, quote, "The government is going to stop the use of Bitcoin." And the government could certainly be an impediment, since it could make purchasing Bitcoin difficult. But think about when the internet first came around. There were those who opposed it back then, but banning it clearly would have been a bad idea. Instead, laws were passed to make it easier to use the internet and conduct online transactions in a way that was more trustworthy and business-friendly. If instead of passing those laws, a country had just banned the internet, it would have suffered in competition with other nations. The same will be true for Bitcoin. The disintermediation that Bitcoin has on the financial system will happen regardless of whether certain countries actively oppose it. Any government that tries to ban it will wind up in a disadvantaged position. Bitcoin as gold 2.0. Quote, "As a thought experiment, imagine there was a base metal, as scarce as gold, but with the following properties. It was a boring gray in color. It was not a good conductor of electricity. It was not particularly strong, was not ductile, nor easily malleable either. It was not useful for any practical or ornamental purpose, but it had one special magical property. it could be transported over a communications channel. If it somehow acquired any value at all, for whatever reason, then anyone wanting to transfer wealth over long distance could buy some, transmit it, and have the recipient sell it. Maybe you could get an initial value circularly, as you've suggested, by people foreseeing its potential usefulness and exchange. I would definitely want some. End quote. Satoshi Nakamoto. I agree with Satoshi. I think of Bitcoin as being gold 2.0, or digital gold. The payment technology aspect of it is still in its relatively early stages, but its value as a scarce item, an item which you can hold, easily secure, and use to transmit value, is undeniable. Saifedean Ammous, who wrote the Bitcoin Standard, talks about the idea that the most important trades that we do are the trades we do with our future selves. Bitcoin's value is clear, whether you're passing wealth along to a future generation or just passing wealth along to your future self. So in the next decade, even if Bitcoin can't be used to, say, buy coffee, there's more than enough value there that you should buy some for yourself. And then, as other people come to recognize the qualities inherent to Bitcoin, you can sell off little pieces of it as its value goes up. Related link: The Bitcoin Standard, The Decentralized Alternative to Central Banking, by Saifedean Ammous. People who buy Bitcoin are putting their own personal skin in the game. These people understand all the qualities mentioned earlier and that Bitcoin is money that you can hold outside of the financial system. It's money you control yourself, if you control your private keys. It's money that, essentially, cannot be taken from you. As people come to understand the properties of Bitcoin, they're going to want to own some. I think you'll see Bitcoin reach a value that is unimaginable. I think most people can't imagine Bitcoin being valued at $500,000 in 10 years. My guess is that it will be a lot higher than that. And there we go. That was Bitcoin is a technological and the technological evolution of the financial system. And this is actually a condensed version if you haven't listened to it yet. He does a four-part or three-part. I can't remember. I'll have it in the show notes. But it's on the Bitcoin Magazine podcast. This is basically a summary of the multi-part series with Bitcoin Tina on essentially his bullish case for Bitcoin. And now one of the analogies that I like to give, like, just because there's a lot of kind of comparisons that you can make as far as like what sort of a technology Bitcoin is. And it's interesting, like he talks about like how quickly these technologies shift. And we're now, you know, 11 years into Bitcoin's life here. And I feel like we're just entering, or at least kind of in 2017, we really just entered the market stage of Bitcoin. Because one of the unique things about Bitcoin is that we got to see it from its very, very beginnings. Like in the automobile analogy that he uses, I think it's far more akin to something like the internal combustion engine, which was invented in the, you know, it's like 1880s, I think, really, is when the internal combustion engine, the four-cycle engine, became a like an actual product, like something that existed in the real world versus an idea that was yet to be realized. And I think that's really what like Bitcoin is comparable to. And I love the money as a simple machine analogy, just because, like, in comparison to something like it can kind of give us an idea of how Bitcoin might evolve and how it might be used going forward, is that you see pulleys and levers and screws and wedges and all this stuff. You don't think about these things. Or wheels, like, they're part of something else. And I think that's going to be a critical way in how we think of Bitcoin moving forward, is that it is the critical piece that makes all of this other stuff attached to it possible. back to the automobile analogy, is that the internal combustion engine was around quite a while before we figured out how to best use it. What other system to put it within in order to utilize the amazing potential, the power efficiency of the of that engine to be used to move people incredible distances at almost zero cost and, well, almost zero cost, a vastly lower cost than having to maintain and take care of a horse, also the far, far cleaner alternative. Like, we think of the, like, our privileged position today is that, like, oh, gas cars are so dirty and all this stuff, but imagine if you had that many horses taking craps and having to be fed and have, like, the cities were disgusting. They're just covered in feces. They stank. It's why diseases spread like wildfire. It was awful. Cars were by leaps and bounds the clean alternative to the to horses, to the older technology. I mean, genuinely, there was no comparison. But that was a fundamental shift in technology. It was the invention of the internal combustion engine, and then figuring out how to best use that, how to create a system around it to do the job that it is most, that is essentially best at doing. And that's where we are with Bitcoin, I think. I think we, just like it took that 30 to 40 year period, essentially, to go from the internal combustion engine to cars being ubiquitous, I think we will see something similar with Bitcoin, except for the fact that I think that timeline is will definitely be shortened, specifically because it's a software environment. So the speed, even considering like the limitations of updating the base layer of Bitcoin because of the consensus mechanism, it's not like normal software. But putting it into another system using the Lightning Network or a sidechain or something that's external to it, but utilizes the base layer as its settlement, uses it as that simple machine, that wheel that goes on the bottom of your luggage to make it incredibly simple to and you know, easy to carry around massive amounts of weight, to put it on the car, et cetera, all these different ways that we can use it. Once we find those ways, it's a matter of software. So the evolutionary process of that is so much faster. And then at the exact same time, we also have the internet to spread the information. So when we have that new system or that new tool, it spreads to other people and it gets tested and it gets iterated on at a rate that was, you know, laughably impossible in, you know, something like the early 1900s. But that's why having a position in it is so important, because we don't know what those next tools are going to be. The idea is that we have a sound money that can be secured through a consensus mechanism. Like, the invention has already been done. Bitcoin is a scarce digital asset. It is digital gold. And even if it goes through no changes and it takes another 10 years to find that way to utilize it in like payment systems or in smart contracts, whatever all these other, which I don't think it will be. I think it will be much sooner that we actually really solve those puzzles, and it looks like we're in the midst of doing it. But even if it is 10 years, I think Bitcoin Tina is absolutely right. I think it's worth as much as gold is in its current state, but arguably a lot more because of what it can do. I don't see any way to trustlessly or securely re-implement a gold standard on a global level. And the fact that Bitcoin can give us those assurances, the monetary assurances of gold, except it can do so on a global system on the internet, like built of software and code, where your Bitcoin genuinely exists in all places at once. There, you don't even quote-unquote transport it. It just exists anywhere that you can unlock it. That's a profound shift in the dynamics of monetary technologies. And it's never been possible as an independent asset. And that is why you've got to start a savings plan. Like, it's so critical, I think, like my opinion, I guess, and Bitcoin Tina's as well, to have some sort of a position in this, no matter what it is, because of the likelihood that this could happen very quickly, and that is the underlying asset. You know, like, you want to be holding real Bitcoin too. That's another key piece to this whole puzzle, is that, you know, when, particularly if you're hedging against some sort of a collapse or some sort of a huge financial insolvency, holding paper gold is not going to do it. Holding paper gold just comes with the same risks in a different location. Whereas holding actual Bitcoin is the equivalent of holding actual gold, except again, it exists anywhere in the world. So start your Bitcoin savings plan at swanbitcoin.com. They actually have some of the lowest fees. I think it's significantly lower than Coinbase, particularly any other like DCA, like auto buy option out there. And if you get over $50 a week, I think is the cutoff, that fee comes all the way down to 0.99%. It's less than 1%. That's the one I'm doing right now. And I may actually bump it up at a later date, but that's just what I can afford at the moment. And it means that you are positioning yourself automatically without having to think about it, without having to worry about it. And if you happen to have a hardware wallet, I know I've been setting this up with like some, you know, family members and like other things like that who have hardware wallets, you can auto withdraw to that wallet. It is a true set it and forget it system. I've set mine and I don't have to do anything with it. So don't forget to do that at swanbitcoin.com. And that's actually where this blog is again. And that's not why I'm reading it. I mean, I read their blog because they have awesome stuff. And that's the one thing, just so everybody, all the listeners know, a sponsorship does not mean I will read your stuff on the podcast. If you want me to mention your name or something and you've got a cool project, which I do have sponsorship slots open, I prefer running one ad per episode just because it gets bogged down really quickly. But I still do have two slots open. So if anybody wants to hit me up, just do so at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com. But if you're hoping that you can pay me to read something on the show, I don't do it that way. I would probably hate doing this in like no time at all if I wasn't just picking what I liked. I've had a couple offers recently, so I wanted to clear that up. But back to the evolution of our financial system, the technological evolution here. So one analogy, I want to get away from the whole combustion engine, and even though I really do enjoy that analogy, but one that I think is kind of closer to home and is awesome, and there's been a couple of developments recently in this regard that I think really kind of shed light on the potential of this, is that Bitcoin will be the underlying rails of the financial system, is that we're going to be literally shifting over all of the stuff on top of the current financial system, and we're going to be tethering it, we're going to be tying it to Bitcoin. I think we're going to have an infrastructure inversion in the global financial system, and that's what we're getting to witness right now, and that's what we'll begin to see. And that's also why I think Bitcoin, even if it doesn't change, a fun fact that I will post on Twitter every once in a while because people don't think about it, and people like, oh, Bitcoin doesn't do enough transactions, blah, 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 at the base layer. Bitcoin does as many transactions, almost shockingly close, actually, as the Fed wire system does. The global, like ACH transfer, when you're putting in your routing number and your account number or whatever, like those transactions, the ones that go over the Fed wire system, that is roughly how many transactions the Bitcoin system can do at the base layer. So scaling, actually, with a couple of layers, as soon as you're putting a couple of layers on this, you can see how, like, extrapolating it wouldn't be that incredibly difficult. Now, undoubtedly, higher layers would come with different sets of trade-offs. Likely the best trade-off to do trustlessly, to maintain decentralization, is a time trade-off. And that's what Lightning does, is that it causes, or it creates a delay, like a delay of like 1 day or 2 days, whatever that time lock of the channel funds are, in order to allow for disputes to be resolved in that case. So what happens is you essentially pay the price of waiting a day or waiting a couple of days for settlement, so that in the case, specifically in this case of a dispute, if everything's cooperative and everything goes great, well, then you get your funds immediately. It just takes one Bitcoin transaction. But what I mean when I say infrastructure inversion, I got a little bit distracted there, is that so AT&T, the AT&T phone network, was one of the a historical monopoly that is very interesting to look at in parallel to the financial system, because they had a veritable monopoly. There was no competition. Like, Ma Bell was the end all be all. Like, it was the phone system of the United States. And there's actually a great book. I think I put this on the Bitcoin Survivors book list on thecryptoeconomy.com if you want to check it out. It's so good. It's so much fun. It's about the phone freaks, as they were called, P-H-R-E-A-K-S. The people who hacked the phone network, because they used like analog signals to communicate over them. There was even a guy who was blind who could whistle into the phone and control it. He could get onto the maintenance lines because he could hit the tones perfectly while whistling. And he would literally just move about throughout the phone network and do whatever he wanted. And they tried to attack people. It was very much like the BitTorrent thing, is they would try to isolate and attack people. In fact, oh my God, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak sold the black boxes, as they were, that would allow you to essentially get on those lines and hit the analog or the mechanical triggers in the network, and you can make phone calls for free on the network. And they would like build these little things, and they sold them to people in their college. They were essentially like the first hackers of that communication system. It's a fascinating book. It's called Hacking Ma Bell. That's the subtitle. It's Exploding the Phone. That's right. So definitely check that out if you hadn't. It's a fun book. But after, when the technology started to shift, when the internet came about and we got TCP/IP and we went from analog to digital, and I think that's the better, there's a really good comparison here into what that shift is happening. When we went from analog to digital, there was no center to the network anymore. With AT&T, when they were the network, they were the only ones that could innovate on it. And the network was singular. Like, it was an entire like national network. So if anything was actually implemented, it couldn't be implemented in one location. It had to be essentially available everywhere. So this made changes in the system shockingly slow, and the actual underlying infrastructure of our communications almost never changed. That's why you had all these, they were able to charge ridiculous prices for long distance, and they held a veritable monopoly on it, and they had a lot of help from government and jurisdictions in maintaining that and going after and attacking the people who found ways around tricking the system, as it were. But when TCP came around, there was this period where these networks were building alongside of each other. And then there was this shift that happened in kind of the very late 90s, early 2000s, 1990s or early 2000s, where there was an infrastructure shift. And the digital rails became so much better at doing the job. Originally, it was slower. There was packet loss. The reliability was lower. There was all these perceived problems. And the people, like the phone giants and like all these other infrastructure companies, just thought it was hilarious. They thought it was like a toy. They were like, nobody will ever use this. This is never going to work. They couldn't see how the evolution was going to play out, and how no matter what happened, the digital space, the digital protocol was going to be more functional. It was necessarily going to eventually reach the point where it was as efficient and could do as much as the old analog system. And then as soon as it got to that point, it was going to be moving so fast that it would 5, 10x, 100x the capacity and the potential of that system. So, like, you essentially had to be an early adopter on the internet, you had to be on it before it was actually part of the system. As soon as that infrastructure inversion started happening, and what I mean by infrastructure inversion is that one day, it just kind of happened that one day the digital infrastructure was so much more capable that the analog phones started having to rely on the digital infrastructure to complete the calls. The heart of the network became digital, despite the fact that the end of the line, the phone in the person's house, was still analog. So in that same way, the inversion that we would see here is that people may still use the dollar and not realize that it's backed by Bitcoin at the bank. An example of this is actually there was a smart contract. Well, first there's been, like, you can tokenize, I know probably everybody knows about, like, stable coins and stuff like that. Like, there's a liquid sidechain, and now you can use Canadian dollars on the liquid sidechain. But somebody has recently also created a Bitcoin-backed dollar, like a currency. And we're beginning to see this transition. Like, I think one of the first steps to that is something that we'll see with, like, BlockFi or Unchained Capital. I know there's a couple other companies that do it. I can't think of them off the top of my head, but that do Bitcoin collateralized loans, so that your Bitcoin is your collateral. And, like, more specifically, like, Unchained is, I think, the only one I know that actually does multi-signature. So you're actually still holding one of the keys, and you can verify exactly the Bitcoin that are backing your loan. But the level of verification and the proof of ownership that can be done in that system to actually use the Bitcoin, I mean, the dollar value of your Bitcoin, but backing it with the actual Bitcoin. And then there are also systems that are like smart contracts or exchanges that can literally like match buyers and sellers for a certain for essentially a token amount on possibly like a sidechain or maybe a financial institution that hedges to stabilize the price of the Bitcoin that they can purchase it at. You know, if they buy a short or a long or whatever it is, they can essentially guarantee the price of an asset for some specific period of time. And in doing so, they can back a contract, a token of some sort, with the value of Bitcoin to make it equal roughly a dollar. And in doing so, you can create a dollar rail system that is settled in Bitcoin. And in the same way that most people's first interaction with the digital system was by still using their analog phone, I think the first way that most people will interact with the Bitcoin system, not knowingly, but they will end up using it, is when the banks switch their infrastructure over to something provable that can be settled and that they know they have ownership of. And what could possibly serve that role better than a digital gold? And I think that infrastructure inversion could come regardless of whether or not there is any additional innovation or building out of the Bitcoin system. I think Bitcoin today can provide that. So if we add on top of that, that we now have a system that innovates at the edges, where anyone can permissionlessly join, and where there is no one to ask permission from to write a new wallet, to create a new system, to create a new smart contract, to create a new sidechain, to create a new node on the Lightning Network, a permissionless decentralized system where anyone can innovate. That's the sort of system that's just like the internet. It's just like the decentralized communications infrastructure that some 14-year-old kid in their garage with a computer can completely change how we think of and how we use Bitcoin. It is truly the internet of money. It is the value and ownership layer of a new internet, of a new financial system, and it will be used thousands of different ways. And like one of the points in the article, you know, money is not supposed to be, it is supposed to be a hedge. There's a great piece that we that I covered on the show, The Yield, The Yield from Money Held by Hans Hermann Hoppe. And it's a great piece. And it's talking about how, like, money is supposed to be, like, when he uses that analogy that I really like of, if you're going to put money away for 20 years, would you put it in just cash? Would you put it in gold, stocks, treasury bonds, et cetera, et cetera? The thing is all of these things have risks to them. All of them have some degree of risk, and we don't really know what their values are going to do. Some could go up, some could go down, but we genuinely know cash is going to become less valuable. There's almost no way that it doesn't. Just the way this system, like if you asked, like 20 years ago, was it cheaper or more expensive to get a burger at McDonald's? You'd be like, oh, it was cheaper in nominal amounts. Like, whose grandfather hasn't told him, I remember when you could go get a soda for a nickel? That's the loss of value in the money. The thing itself did not become more expensive. The money was debased. We lost the value of the money. If he had saved his, you know, wages back then, they wouldn't buy Jack. If he'd saved a nickel, he certainly wouldn't be able to buy a soda with it. Was it $1.50 for a soda these days? And people actually expect this of our money without realizing that money is the one tool. It is the one good in society that is so ubiquitous that it's actually not supposed to lose value. It's supposed to be the one place so that we don't have to constantly put additional things, additional capital at risk, so that we don't have to be, our value isn't tied up in some liability, or it doesn't have counterparty risk, which tethers things in the economy together, meaning that when one thing crashes, the next thing crashes. It's like putting dominoes very close together, whereas the good of money, to be able to store money in a society rather than having to invest it in stocks where somebody else could destroy the value or somebody else could loan it out in a bank, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The value of that is that it separates, it pulls the dominoes further apart, because money is that fundamental good that hedges against uncertainty. It's a bearer asset. It's the one thing that doesn't have counterparty risk, so that we can store it in that. We can have capital available that anyone in the society is willing to trade for, no matter what the conditions are, no matter how badly leveraged we are. That tool of capital storage always works. It's the good of last resort. To destroy that, to make its value uncertain, and to debase that, is to destroy the most critical security system of the economy. It's literally like shaving away the strength, the bulkiness out of your foundation, and, you know, thinking as long as the wind doesn't blow, this building will still hold up. Such a dangerous game to play. And because of that, those characteristics of money, even though we don't think about them, even though we don't think about, like, you know, wheels when we're using them, like we don't think, oh God, wheels are the best. Every time I get in my car, look how fast I can go places. I love wheels. They're invisible. That's what money is. Money is supposed to be that. And because of that, we don't know what it's, we've forgotten how to distinguish the difference between a good and a bad money. We have simply had bad money forced on us and think that there is no alternative. We never had to stop and sit down. It's like, what is a good money? We're essentially blind shoppers right now. And people are going to realize that how critical the tool of money is. And what's funny is they don't even have to realize it. If Bitcoin continues to serve that role, if it continues to be good money with static demand, its value will still naturally rise. which means that people, even not understanding it, will go looking for it, will wonder why it continues to get more valuable. Why does it continue to appreciate against the dollar? And the longer it exists, the longer it survives, the less people will be worried about it suddenly not existing, and the more obvious it will be that it is an excellent long-term store of value, and the entire thing will be self-reinforcing. You know, even backed by unbelievable powers historically, even backed by widespread religions, it doesn't matter. A good money drives out a bad money. It happens whether we consciously realize it or not. And that's why it is absolutely critical that we start to investigate the difference, and we start to look at what makes a good money and a bad money, and actually make that decision, because the rug can get pulled out of us, out from under us, very, very quickly. And without being positioned properly, it could cost a great deal. Civilizations literally live and die based on the value and the security of their money. That is why I highly recommend a long-term perspective and auto DCA, Bitcoin savings plan with Swan Bitcoin. They're by far the best place to do that. And why I think this is the one of the most important things we can learn in this current environment. I think we are witnessing one of the most profound wealth transfers that our age will provide. Letting that pass by is not recommended. Okay, that'll close us. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Bitcoin Tina, for the article, and Swan Signal, the blog over at swanbitcoin.com, for posting this stuff. This has been, they hit it out the gate like amazingly so. Like, their first piece was the 10 million Bitcoiners, the intransigent minority. Really, really good stuff, and they do a great job of explaining things. That's one of the things that Swan Bitcoin is actually focused on, is education. They've got the Give Bitcoin Guide, which I'm doing the audio for as well. And then they've got this blog. So if you want to do a little bit of exploring, it's a really, really great place to do so. And obviously they have, you know, the Bitcoin savings plan as well. So, you know, all in one package right there. And again, if you guys want to support the show, if you've got like a really cool Bitcoin related project to share out, get in touch with me. It's sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com. Tell me about what you got. Is it a cool company? Is it Bitcoin only? What are you trying to build? And I've got a couple of pricing options available for that. So you don't have to spend like a ton of money if you don't want. If you got something cool to share, I'd love to check it out. And, you know, I'd love for you to support and help keep the Audible of the Bitcoin space alive. That's what we do here. I am Guy Swan, the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we try to make all of this information, all of these amazing pieces, all of this history, all of the economics of this revolutionary technology accessible as possible to as many people as possible. And so that's why I'm here. That's why I'm doing this. And if you want to support that, that would be awesome. You can either hit me up at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com, hit me up on patreon.com if you just want to donate to the show and become a patron. And of course, you get access to the Crypto Economy Crew Telegram. We got an awesome gang of people in there. So knowledgeable about stuff. I've used them more than anything as just a way to pick people's brains and ask questions. Definitely do that if you can. But there is always a way that you can support this show, is subscribe and share this out with everybody you know in the Bitcoin and crypto space. I love you all. Thank you for listening. And thank you for taking this crazy ride with me. Until next time, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.